This is the Financial Sense News Hour with the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. Now, here's the Financial Sense News team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome to the Big Picture for this week, everyone. And the turbulence that we have seen since the beginning of the year continues this week. Oil prices hit record lows this week as prices got as low as $26 a barrel. That's thrilling if you're at the pump, but it may not be thrilling for other people. And stocks fell to new lows and are now back in rally mode right now. You know, economic growth has been decelerating both here and abroad. And as we discussed in our forecast show, one of the wild cards this year is a policy mistake coming from the Fed. I mean, unlike the past when the Fed raised interest rates, the economy was heating up and inflation was on the rise. But this cycle, inflation is almost non-existent and economic growth has become anemic. So experts from the financial world, the IMF, the World Bank, have warned the Fed to wait before raising rates. But last December, the Fed went ahead and raised rates, citing optimism and an improving economy and expectations for rising inflation. So given the economic reports we've seen, falling commodity prices, we've seen the opposite, yet they keep telling the markets they expect to raise interest rates by another 1% this year. Well, the markets don't like that. They disagree with the Fed's assessment and the economic data they believe don't support the Fed's view of where the world is right now. So this is one of the sources of anxiety.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the world the way it works today, we're currently in a world that if this market turbulence continues, it's going to push the economy further towards recession. I mean, if you think about it, John, you know, people were feeling pretty good over the last couple of years. Housing prices have rebounded. Gasoline prices have fallen. Interest rates have come down. This has allowed homeowners to refinance their home. They've seen their homes go up in value. The stock market has gone up. So all of this feeds into optimism. But if you have the kind of turbulence where you have market turmoil, as we're seeing in the world today, the further that continues, that's going to start to weigh on consumer confidence. And so it's no surprise in the month of December, we saw retail sales come in anemically. They were down from the previous month and down. They were only up about 2.5% a year. So how long does this turbulence take place or continue before it starts to weigh on the minds of consumer? Now, the recession indicators are starting to rise. The Fed is raising the cost of capital, if you think what they're doing, for firms. And that's already hamstrung by the impact of, let's say, a rising U.S. dollar. The thing that plagued the markets last year and what we're seeing now, the ongoing Chinese currency devaluation, will sustain deflationary pressures on the emerging markets as well as here at home in the U.S. Now, the Fed is looking at employment growth. That's one of the figures you keep hearing them sign. You know, we're down to a 5% unemployment rate. But this, John, is a lagging indicator. And here's what happens in the real world. If profits continue to contract as they are doing now, companies will begin to reverse their hiring plans. And if they are facing a margin squeeze on profits, the thing that they're seeing, it's not just a rising dollar, but it's also rising wage costs. And the two of them together, we're seeing shrinking sales are pressuring margins at a time when balance sheets have been leveraged up. So as a result of the Fed's actions, we're seeing a widening of corporate bond spreads. What does that mean? It costs more to borrow money if you're a corporation. Rising corporate bond spreads are a leading indicator also of the labor market. You can pair them together. If rates start to rise in the corporate world, it's not too much longer or further before you start to see the unemployment claims start to rise. So right now, the market is anticipating a steady rise in unemployment claims as the year progresses. We've already seen, if you think about that, in the energy sector, we've seen the energy sector lay off thousands, tens of thousands of employees. I think last year, the energy sector shed several hundred thousand jobs, and these are high-paying jobs. So we've already seen it in the energy sector. There's a risk here. If the Fed continues, it could actually spread to other sectors of the economy. If that were to happen, the Fed then would be forced to downgrade its outlook. I mean, if you boil this all down, right now we're operating in an environment of what we call the four Ds: deflation, deleveraging, diverging monetary policy, and dollar strength. And if you take a look at what we're doing versus what the rest of the world is doing, the Fed is out of step with the global monetary policy right now. And the result is this turbulence and volatility that we are seeing now as liquidity is withdrawn from the financial markets. So, as you're starting to see now, a few more individuals, and we saw this at Davos this week, are really questioning the Fed's perverse logic. And this goes, John, as you pointed out, and we talked about this last week, from the IMF, the World Bank, and astute financial experts, everyone from Jeffrey Gundlach to Ray Dalio, who spoke vociferously this week about what the Fed is doing and the risk of making a serious policy mistake. I mean, if you follow the logic, and this is what the Fed's doing, hiking rates only to cut them later is a perverse logic. If the Fed is worried about a recession later on, that they want to have some ammunition to combat it, then why catalyze one by tightening credit conditions? You already have that with the U.S. dollar is already exacting a major growth and profit toll from companies. One of the main reasons, besides, let's say, a fall in profits in the energy sector, but one of the main reasons you saw profits fall last year for the S&P and the Dow companies was a rising dollar. So if you're getting 40 to 50% of your sales overseas, then what happens is the dollar rises against those currencies. When you translate those sales back into dollars, you have falling sales, falling profits. So if they persist in their actions, as they're doing now, or at least as they're talking of doing, we could experience further market turmoil, and they could face an economic backlash, as we're currently starting to see. A lot of people starting to question, what the heck are you guys doing?
Well, we have heard from many of the technicians who've been here on the program before, who believe that we're actually in the beginning stages of a bear market. I mean, we've seen economic reports that indicate the economy is slowing down again. So in the past, they've held off from tightening, or at least postponed it like they did last year. So what do you think? I mean, are they going to do, as we first do a first rate hike this year, is expected, what, in March? Are we playing this game all over again this year?
Well, I mean, if this market turbulence continues, it's going to push the economy towards a recession. I mean, right now, our own recession indicator and others that are out there, recession indicators are starting to rise. The Fed is raising the cost of capital for firms already hamstrung by the impact of the U.S. dollar. And so you're already starting to see a lot of these things happen, John. I mean, what are we worried about? We're worried about China. We're worried about Chinese devaluation. And the other thing is we're worried about corporate profits. And corporate profits are sort of a forerunner. And many would argue there's already a recession in corporate profits because they were down last year and they're expected. They've been downgrading corporate profits for a lot of the S&P companies. In fact, a lot of the companies reporting so far, yeah, they're beating estimates, but they're beating lower estimates. So we're already starting to see this. We're seeing labor markets are tight right now, but once again, the labor markets are sort of a lagging indicator. That's sort of the last thing to go up. So really, if the Fed is looking forward, they really should be looking what the markets are telling them. The problem is the people at the Fed are mainly academics. They don't follow the markets, and they don't follow a lot of what is going on. Yes, they see when, you know, it catches their attention when we had severe downdraft, as we did, let's say, in August last year when China devalued and the stock market lost 12% of its value. That got the Fed's attention. So they didn't go in September. They didn't go in October, but they finally went in December. And all of this is continuing because it's creating, it's adding another element of uncertainty to the financial markets, because the financial people are saying, look, if you continue to tighten, what that's going to do, it's going to raise interest rates in the United States, which makes the United States a more attractive place to invest if you're looking for income. I mean, interest rates in Europe right now are at a negative interest rate. So, you know, almost if you look at 7 years and under, you actually have negative interest rates in Europe, and then there's really not too much that you can get in Europe. I mean, it's hard to get 1% unless you go over, you know, to countries like Greece. It's hard to believe that Spanish and Italian and Portuguese bond yields are lower than U.S. Treasuries. So as global money is looking for a place to park, they're shopping around the globe. In a rising dollar and rising interest rates makes the U.S. more attractive. So you're seeing capital outflows of China and elsewhere in the world. And if the Fed continues to do this, this is only going to heighten dollar strength. The dollar is going to get stronger. Interest rates will rise and more capital outflows will come out of emerging markets. It'll come out of Europe and it's going to create more turbulence. And there's one thing the markets hate. And that's uncertainty. And I think that explains much of this kind of sideways back and forth action that we saw in the markets last year. Because what were we thinking of? We were thinking, were they going to raise? Are they not going to raise? We spent 12 months talking about that. And it's unlikely, John, that we're going to spend 12 months talking about the very same thing this year. So you've got a lot of things that are not working well right now. And the Fed is only adding to that uncertainty by persisting in this.
Well, it would seem like one of the problems is that the Fed almost creates some of its own problems. In other words, they'll have a press conference and they'll say something, and then a number of the Fed governors will come out in interviews with the press itself and say something different or something. You know, it seems to create a lot of dissonance, and so people are uncertain as to whether there's a unity here.
Yeah, it was one of the shows that we did in the month of December, One and Shut Up. And that's what they really need to do. You know, you have an FOMC meeting, you raised interest rates, you had a press conference afterwards. You know, Fed governors need to be singing from the same hymn book. You can't have the chairman say something in a press conference, and then immediately during the week, you've got a couple others saying something different. And right now, we've got two doves in the Fed that have been out saying, well, maybe we shouldn't raise, or maybe we ought to hold back and just watch what happens. But the overall consensus with the other governors and the chairman is, no, we're going to raise interest rates. They're sticking to that mantra. So this is just, as John, as it always does, creates more uncertainty for the financial markets, because the financial markets are looking at what's happening. You're having liquidity being withdrawn from the market. You've got rising interest rates, which is making it difficult for the emerging markets, especially China and the rest of Asia. And they're still on this track while the rest of the central banks, from the ECB to the Bank of Japan to the Bank of China, is in an easing mode. So what you have is asymmetric risk in the financial markets with dissynchronous monetary policy. And that always is good for a lot of turbulence.
So if we just froze everything right where we are right now, what's your assessment of the most likely outcome looking forward from this moment?
Well, I mean, we can boil down all this turbulence in the market to two problems that are besetting the market. Right now, it's a rising U.S. dollar, and the other one is falling oil prices. And these two combinations are creating strong headwinds that are forcing a withdrawal of liquidity from the financial system. That's the other story here that isn't being picked up too much by the media. The problem is being created by a rising dollar, which in many ways is a de facto tightening of the financial system, especially in a world of zero interest rates. Currencies are one way that monetary policy gets transmitted through the financial system. I mean, the Chinese, who peg their currency to the U.S. dollar, have expended $700 billion defending their peg. And that was only, what, a 3% devaluation? The Saudis, who are doing the same, pegging their currency to the dollar, they've spent $100 billion. So just between those two central banks, you're talking about $800 billion that has been withdrawn from the market, because what they're doing is they're pulling down their reserves to defend their peg. And it's not just the central banks. Sovereign wealth funds have been dumping stocks as declining oil prices are leading to budget deficits in many of these OPEC countries that depend on oil revenues to run the government.
The big story for me is, look, it's primarily about the Fed. I know there's a lot of concerns about China as well, which we can maybe get to later in the program. But fundamentally, the big issue for me is that the world is experiencing a monetary policy shock. We don't have a global central bank. The Fed is the nearest we've got to it. And what's appropriate policy for the US economy with their labor market seemingly close to full employment is not appropriate policy for the rest of the world. There's still a very big global output gap. So the Fed tightening monetary policy is imposing an inappropriate tightening of global financial conditions on the rest of the world. And I think we see that in commodity prices. We see that in falling foreign exchange reserves, particularly in China. We see that in that, which is in turn a result of the depreciation pressure on currencies around the world that the strong dollar is producing. Yeah. So the big question is this going to stop? Are the markets going to call the Fed's bluff? And I think for me, the key is that the message we've actually had from the Fed is that their pain threshold on for financial turbulence, increased volatility is actually relatively high.
Voice there of Richard Eiley, who is chief economist at BNP Paribas. And, you know, Jim, the IMF, the World Bank and others in the financial world are really calling into question what it is the Fed is doing right now. And what we don't know is exactly what the Fed's tolerance for pain might be.
Yeah, he was making reference to that because, you know, the problem is, and what he's making reference to is we don't have a world central bank. The Fed is probably the closest thing that we have to a global central bank. But the Fed's policy is out of sync with the rest of the world. You know, and this was much different than in 2009 and 2014. You had monetary policy that was pretty much in sync. So the markets were a lot more stable during that period of time. And as a result of that, you had more stability. But as that gentleman said, what the Fed does affects the rest of the world. I mean, you can't have countries, the second largest economy in the world, China, peg its currency to the dollar. China's currency, as the dollar has risen 28% against most major currencies, it's impacting China. So the world's second largest economy is decelerating rather rapidly. And they're trying to maintain that peg, and the way they're doing it is selling off their currency reserves. And so they're selling their dollars, and then they're buying their own currency, and that's withdrawing liquidity from the system. And John, this is not sustainable. They've gone through 25% of their reserves already with just a 3% devaluation. And that's why the big question right now is there's talk going around the international markets that the next move by China may not be this slow incremental thing. Well, we'll devalue the currency another 3%. They might do it all in one shot and just overnight, very much like 1997, where you saw a currency devaluation. It all takes place at once and they devalue their currency by 15%.
Yeah, and that's quite a shock. You know, you mentioned the two big macro factors that are plaguing the markets right now. We have a rising dollar and falling oil prices, and both of those are deflationary. So why do you think, despite all of this global quantitative easing, that it really didn't lead to hyperinflation? I mean, the gold crowd were just digging in saying, this is it, here she goes, and it just didn't happen. It was predicted by many experts, too.
I mean, if you look at the formula for inflation, it's money and credit divided by goods and services. So the more money and credit chasing goods and services, that is what gives you inflation. Unfortunately, what we saw happen during the financial crisis is credit came to a screeching halt and basically collapsed. So one way of looking at this, the Fed's QE simply replaced credit, so you didn't see this real inflation. To get that going, you really have to have expanding credit and an expanding money injections into the economy. More money chasing fewer goods is what gives you inflation. But unlike the last decade, especially when Greenspan began to slash rates, bringing the Fed funds rate down to 1%, you had money expansion combined with credit expansion, both expanding at the same time, and that led to higher inflation rates. If you look at what the Fed has done, it has already tightened credit considerably. The Atlanta Fed puts out a graph, it's called the shadow funds rate, and it shows that the Fed has already tightened by close to 300 basis points. In other words, with quantitative easing and the rise in the dollar, we've gone from almost the equivalent of a negative 2.5% to basically where we are today, 0.5%. And this is already being reflected. You can see this in the bond market as corporate credit spreads have widened over sovereign bonds. But what happens when interest rates rise? It's leading to less borrowing for stock buybacks. IPOs have slowed down or have been postponed. Central banks are selling off their reserve holdings. So all of this, we've seen considerable tightening, and that's what the Fed's own Atlanta Fed is showing. They've already tightened substantially, and that has taken place, and which is one of the reasons another slowdown you're starting to see in the corporate world.
Now, here's the question. I mean, they're saying they're going to do this again, despite advice coming from some of their colleagues and other central banks. If the Fed continues to persist in raising and the rates go up, what's going to happen then?
Well, you know, as we talked about, one of the wild cards this year in the market, and in fact, in not just us that is noting this, is a policy mistake. You know, we have a saying here on the program, the Fed will keep doing what it's doing until they break something, either in the economy or financial markets. Right now, the financial markets are breaking down both here and abroad, and it doesn't matter where you look, either here or elsewhere around the globe, markets are negative for this year, and it's global.
You know, since the first of the year, the markets have fallen here in the United States. I mean, every single week, as a matter of fact. It got off with a turbulent bang and hasn't quit since then. We've been in rally mode this week, but now how long does this rally last without some kind of meaningful change to alter the macro environment? Just how bad does it have to get before the Fed throws in the towel and changes course?
Well, I mean, you know, you take a look at, you saw them withhold from raising interest rates in September and October, given what was happening in the financial markets. Well, take a look what's happened this year. If we take a look at, there's stocks that are 89% of the, let's say, the Russell 3000 index are down 15% or more from their highs. Over 70% are down 20% from their highs. Almost 60% are down 25% from their highs. So when you look at the general indexes, it sort of hides what's, let's say, taking place below the surface. You have large cap stocks, which kind of make the index look much better than what is going on within the indexes themselves. I mean, 50% of stocks in the Russell are down 30% or more. And so, you know, if you look at things like the Russell, a lot of people are saying, could this be a bear market or is this simply a correction? The bulls would argue this is a correction, an ongoing bull market. The bears would argue that we've broke important trend lines, as John Kosar and I talked about in hour one. We already have surpassed and broken below the levels that were reached in August and September last year on the Russell. So we're already breaking to lower lows, which is one thing why you hear a lot of technicians on the show really comment about what they're doing. And the other thing that we're seeing is, you know, we've seen since, if you take a look at the, let's say, the last 100 years, we've had 30 declines in the market of 20% or more going all the way back to, let's say, 1921. The mean decline has been roughly about 34%. Those declines tend to be much, much steeper in a recession. And that's why you're seeing a little bit more optimism, even among some of the technicians. They're cautious. And the duration of those declines are roughly about 8 months. But once again, the majority of those type of declines occurred at a time that the U.S. economy was experiencing a recession, which we are not right now. The economy is still growing. It's growing anemically, but we're, thank goodness, we're still not in a recession. So does this mean if this is a bear market, it's going to be Papa Bear or a Mother Bear market? Not necessarily. It could be a small cyclical bear market, maybe a 20% correction, which is what people generally define a bear market. Well, we've already seen that with the broader companies within the indexes. And it could be much shorter in duration. And a lot of that can depend on a policy shift. So that's why we're paying a lot of attention. And I mean, John, anywhere you look around the globe, we're seeing falling prices. So I would be really surprised, given the FOMC meeting, upcoming FOMC meeting, if they don't issue something in their statement or press conference, they're saying, well, we're going to watch the data. We're not in a hurry to raise. They need to do something. You can't just reverse course and flip-flop. Hey, we raised it in the month of December. Now we're going to lower it. They look like idiots. So a lot of their credibility is at stake here. But, I mean, as bad as it is here, it's actually worse overseas. I mean, there are very few sectors that are holding up here. The ones that are doing much better are healthcare, things like consumer staples and utilities and telecom. They're holding up much better. Those are the kind of sectors you'd want to be in if we indeed were moving towards or closer to a recession as the recession gauges start to rise. So what we're seeing here in our own markets, as well as what we're seeing globally, the problem is if this persists much longer, the Fed is going to risk throwing the rest of the world and the U.S. economy into another recession.
Yeah, and the question is then, so what should the Fed be doing right now? Should they actually try a reverse course and perhaps become a little more dovish?
Central banks and monetary policy and economic policy have to create the demand. And the mechanism, like in 1937, is such that through quantitative easing, fiscal policy, something or other, these are all cycles.
Yeah.
And we all go past through the cycles and we all get done. And sometimes we have debt restructuring. We work ourselves through that. So I think when I say pessimistic, I want to be clear that I think that the risks are asymmetric so much on the downside.
Yes.
And I think that the awareness of that asymmetry is very important by central banks and even fiscal policymakers at this time. That's the main thing. I don't want to, the moods can trap investors,
right?
Because what happens is they're too responsive. Mutual funds will tend to sell in response to these things. I don't want to prompt concern, but I do want to prompt an analysis of the question of the decreased effectiveness of monetary policy in a contraction. This will be a negative for the economy, this market movement. And that'll mean, as we look at that, that the Fed should remain flexible, right? It shouldn't be so wedded to a path.
I think they're not. We already heard some of that from some of the people who have spoken.
Well, what a little bit concerns me is the lack of these concerns 6 or 12 months ago, because the forces behind that existed 6 or 12 months ago. So I think, anyway, I hope you're right.
Bottom line is, Ray, that the Fed's arsenal is compromised at this point, and what they do have left is not going to be as effective as we would like.
Yes, I believe so.
Ray Dalio from Bridgewater Associates, Jim.
Yeah, I don't believe it would make sense, as Dalio talked about, maybe to cut rates right now. I mean, the Fed, as I mentioned, would probably lose a lot of its credibility. I mean, you spend a whole year telling us you're going to raise rates. The minute you raise them, a month later, you reverse course. They would look really foolish at that point. But they should stop all of this talk about tightening further. And they can do that by lowering their dot plots. I mean, there are several things that they can do to sort of assuage the market's fears. They could do things like, okay, we've raised rates. We're going to sit back. We're going to watch developments as they unfold and maybe give us some kind of benchmark and say, hey, unless this happens, we're unlikely to go further. So the market could have something or some degree of certainty they can hang their hat in. But, they can go on pause, and that would help not only us here, but the global economy. They really need to say, hey, we don't like what we're seeing right now, and before we move, we're going to need to see improvements in these particular areas before we proceed any further. That would bring a little bit of more certainty to the global markets. It would probably ease some of the pressure on the rising dollar. It would improve here and abroad and take the pressure off, more importantly, off corporate profits. Because if corporate profits continue to get squeezed, watch what's going to happen with unemployment claims. It's, what happens to a business? Your margins get squeezed, your sales decline. What do? You start cutting costs, and one of the costs you cut is employment.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, there were two factors weighing on the markets, both the dollar and oil. And oil's the big question. I mean, how long is it going to stay where it is right now? Obviously, Saudi Arabia is trying to drive the prices down to weigh hard, shall we say, upon the fracking industry and bankrupt them, get them out of business. But the markets have rallied these last few days as the oil prices bottomed when they hit $26 a barrel. Never thought we'd see that one again, did you, Jim?
No. I remember when they were bringing that up last year. I remember my friend Gary Schilling was talking about $20 oil, and some people were talking about $10 oil. We never got there last year, but we certainly got into the $20 range this year, and some are saying we're not done yet.
Yeah, and of course, oil's back above $30 a barrel, but that doesn't mean, like you say, we're totally done. It could reverse and go back down before this whole little war is all over with.
you know, we've been talking mainly about a Fed policy mistake here, but oil is a completely different subject, the product of not only supply and demand factors, but combined with geopolitical factors. The problem is OPEC and Russia continue to pump record amounts of oil. So any reduction in oil is going to occur mainly in the U.S. and within Western oil companies. Saudi Arabia is keeping production high and vying with Iran for maintaining market share, especially with China. So, I mean, China is in a sweet spot right now, negotiating with, let's say, new production coming out of Iran, also with what Saudi Arabia is producing. And Saudi Arabia is saying, we're not going to cede and cut back only to have Iran take market share. At the same time, you have Iran saying, you know what? We're going to keep pumping. We want to regain our market share that we had before sanctions were put into effect. So the market is likely to stay well supplied until a couple of things happen. Western production drops further and global demand continues to increase. Now, the good news is demand for oil continues to increase despite slowing economies. So a slowing economy does not mean that oil demand will stop rising. It still continues to go up, and that demand is mainly coming, John, from the emerging world. So oil prices are likely to remain weak until Western production continues to fall to the point it balances out with demand, and the markets are responding right now to lower prices, worried that this implies slowing economic growth. I mean, there are economies in recession like Brazil and Russia, and there's others that are verging on the border of a recession. So the issue with oil is there's simply too much production.
So eventually, assuming that this happens, are we likely to swing in the other direction?
You know, that's funny. The oil markets have always gone to extremes, extremes on the low end. It's not the first time we've seen this happen. Happened in 86. It happened in 98. We saw the price of oil drop to $10 a barrel. 2 years later, it was at $35 a barrel. And that's a high probability. The oil industry is contracting. It's slashing capital expenditures, which means future production eventually is going to decline, because when you produce this stuff, you have to replace it. They're already laying off tens of thousands. I think last year, 200,000 workers, over 200,000 workers lost their jobs in the energy sector. And it's going to take a much higher price and stability of that much higher price before you're going to see capital expenditures ramp up again. So it is going to lead, John, to price spikes in the long run down the road.
If we come back to the larger issue regarding Fed policy, despite the market turmoil, there doesn't seem to be any backing away from the Fed's intentions to raise rates. This week at Davos, several financial luminaries were calling for the Fed to change their tune.
Let's talk about monetary policy and the long-term debt cycle. There's a business cycle that we're used to, lasts 5 to 10 years, and then there's such a thing as a long-term debt cycle. And the problems at the end of a long-term debt cycle is it's more difficult for the Federal Reserve or central banks to ease monetary policy. Because when you hit zero, you can't lose in lower interest rates anymore. When you have large spreads, in other words, higher expected returns of equities or bonds, and they do quantitative easing, the seller of those bonds receives cash and they buy other financial assets. And that process pushes those financial asset prices up and lowers their expected return. Then there is not much spread. So, for example, we have about a 2% bond yield, cash being nothing. In Europe and in Japan, there is no spread. That means that monetary policy makes it more difficult to either have credit growth or monetary growth. That end of the long-term debt cycle is the issue that means that the risks are asymmetric on the downside, because asset prices are comparatively high. At the same time, there's not an ability to ease. That asymmetric risk exists all around the world. So every country in the world needs an easier monetary policy. So that's that. As regards China, China is also dealing with the debt issue. I mean, a basic notion is you can't increase your debt faster than your income for long. And that means that they're going through an adjustment process, which means slower growth. And with slower growth, less inflation pressures. So we're now in a situation globally where China plays an important role on the rest of the world, and the rest of the world plays a role on China. And that is negative.
So if I were to decipher this, though, you ended on negative. To fully put it in a sentence, you think we're in a bad shape here.
I think the risks are asymmetric on the downside. That's why I said before that I think the next major move in Fed policy will be toward a quantitative easing, not toward a tightening.
Do you think it will be effective? I mean, you point out that there's not a lot that we can do with monetary policy unless you get a quantitative easing.
I think it's going to be much more difficult this next time. And I think that there's going to, it's pushing on a string. The term pushing on a string began in 1935. It's that challenge. That means that there's going to need to be fiscal policy with monetary policy. That's a risky set of circumstances because politically, fiscal policy is controversial. Do you tighten? Do you ease? So I think that's why talking about how the machine works is an important thing.
Yeah, that was Ray Dalio again. And here's Bill Gross.
For instance, the ECB, they have negative interest rates. Can they lower interest rates even further in order to prop up their bond and equity markets? Perhaps. But at some point when an interest rates go so negative, say minus 50 or minus 1% or minus 1.5%, then investors and, everyday citizens basically say, I prefer to own cash as opposed to invest my money in an overnight security that, takes 1 or 1.5% from me. So there are limitations in terms of what central banks can do, and I think investors are basically beginning to sense that yes, certain central banks can continue to lower interest rates, and yes, there's a possibility, I suppose, of additional QEs from one corner or another. But the efficacy of central bank policy and monetary policy is reaching an end in terms of its ability to generate economic growth and asset prices on a higher and higher level.
So let's say they do listen and then hold back from raising rates. What do they do when the next crisis erupts or when we head into a recession here and globally as well?
Well, they're probably going to resort, as Dalio referred to, as another round of quantitative easing, because when you have interest rates this low, I mean, the Fed just raised interest rates from a quarter of a point to a half a point. So if they lower them from a half a point to a quarter of a point, that really isn't going to do much. So they're going to have to go back to quantitative easing. That's what happens when you're zero bound. But we've learned that, as Gross just mentioned there, monetary policy has its limitations. To be effective, it really needs to be combined with fiscal policy. And for that, you need some kind of unity in government. However, it is what I do expect to see happen in the next downturn. You could see massive fiscal stimulus that ends up being monetized by the Fed through QE. And then that, John, gets the Fed its inflation goals and beyond. And I think that's what's going to happen next time.
So if we try to package this all together so people understand, what you think is that the Fed has made a major policy error here, especially since a lot of the Fed's job is managing expectations, not just money. This has caused the dollar to rise, which is now creating havoc in global markets, forcing liquidity to be withdrawn from the financial markets, which is what we're seeing play out in the financial markets globally. And that is a result of the strengthening dollar and higher interest rates here in the United States. And what you believe is that if they persist in continuing to tighten, that could not only unravel the financial markets, but also risk throwing the U.S. economy back down into a recession. Remember, it's an election year, too. They're walking an incredibly razor line here and should be really less strident about their policy. Here's Ray Dalio again.
I think what the Fed is doing that is, I think, mistaken, is that they're looking at the short-term economic cycle. You know, the classic is, if you're operating with a GDP gap, slack gets tighter, unemployment rates get lower, that at that point in the cycle, it's appropriate to tighten monetary policy. And that's very classic. And that's a very short-term business cycle perspective. But there is such a thing as a longer-term debt cycle. And I don't think they're giving enough attention to that.
Yeah, there's Dalio saying basically they're not giving enough attention to the long-term debt cycle. So I guess our next topic here on the big picture, Jim, is given the situation where we are, what do investors do given this market? Because we need to turn this into something pragmatic for our listeners as the big picture continues at financialsense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
You know, Financial Sense NewsHour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense NewsHour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
Neil Dutta joins us today. He's the head of economics at Renaissance Macro Research. And Neil, there's a lot of concern by investors that we've seen subpar economic growth here in the U.S. and that it's not going to provide the necessary cushion to perhaps weather an ongoing downturn in the global economy. Where do you at Renaissance Macro, given a lot of the trends and the data that you look at, place these concerns in terms of your outlook for the U.S. this year?
Well, I think the first part of that is just to disagree slightly with the premise. Remember that over the last 6 to 8 quarters, the U.S. economy has registered growth of 2.5 to 3% on average. Now, it is true that in the fourth quarter, we've seen a bit of a slowdown. The Atlanta Fed, for example, is tracking GDP growth of barely 1%. Now, the question is, you know, whether that is a temporary phenomenon or something that's longer lasting. And most of the weakness in growth, you know, really in the second half of 2015, is largely related to a sharp inventory correction that cut growth by almost a percentage point in the second half of the year. Inventory adjustments tend to be temporary, particularly given the reasonably healthy pace in real final sales. So, you know, I think that that will be the case again. And once this inventory correction fades, I think the stronger underlying fundamentals begin to take over. You know, in addition, I think we're going to see tailwinds to growth from stronger public sector spending. In fact, the Fed, for example, the Fed staff recently upgraded their medium-term economic outlook because of what's going on in the public sector. For example, the recent deal inked and signed in D.C., you know, late last year. So you see stronger public sector spending, steady growth in consumer spending, less of a drag in inventories. And I think that gets you, you know, towards 2.5% growth outlook. Now, that's not 3%. It's not 4%. It's not as high as, you know, many people want. But it's at the same time solidly above trend and more than enough to keep pushing the unemployment rate down. The other sort of big yawning gap right now is this sharp disconnect between GDP data, at least in the fourth quarter, and employment data. And the question we need to answer is why employment data has been so strong of late, despite the continued decline in GDP tracking estimates. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that there are idiosyncratic factors weighing on the GDP numbers. Inventories, you know, the energy capex story, the widening of the trade deficit, you know, a lot of these things aren't going to be nearly as severe in 2016 as they were in 2015.
Last segment of The Big Picture. Welcome back, by the way. Jim Poplava, John Loeffler here with you. We looked at the Fed and its proposal again to raise interest rates this year, ostensibly in March, although we may start playing the same game we played last year. It was almost like a game of chicken. But then the question will be, what will the results of that be? And that's created much uncertainty in the markets. Nevertheless, investors are there to make money. So theoretically, if you're trying to make money and you're in this kind of an environment, what is a person to do? And that is the subject of our conversation here.
Well, I mean, there's a couple things that you can do. I mean, depending on what your goals are, what kind of investor, you know, what's your tolerance for risk. But John, a lot of the technicians will say, well, go to cash. We don't agree that you should pull everything out of the market and go to cash, because that's really getting into market timing. And we've seen play out over the years. That's exactly what investors did in 2009. There are a lot of investors that have remained in cash since that time. And then there was another period of time in 2011 where it was very, very turbulent, very much like what we're experiencing now. But I think it was even more turbulent when you think about it. We had Fukushima, we had the Arab Spring, we had rising oil prices, downgrading of U.S. debt, crisis in Europe with the pig countries. All those things were taking place. And then all of a sudden, the Fed came back with quantitative easing. So, I mean, you don't want to go completely to cash. Now, it makes some sense maybe to take some of the profits off the table, as many of our technicians have urged investors to do, to say, hey, if you want to be safe, you know, might take some chips off the table and get a little bit more conservative. But in a world where you have zero interest rates, and you got to remember, we've been here for 8 years now, and we could be here for another, who knows, it could be another decade, unless something dramatically changes on the macro front. And I just don't see that happening right now, because you have aging demographics in Europe, China, much of Asia. Actually, the best demographics are in the U.S. right now. So when you have those things going on, you don't want to go completely out of something. And if you go into cash, how are you going to survive? I mean, think of people that have been in cash for 8 years. They've earned nothing. I mean, you're getting nothing in a money market fund. In CDs, do you really want to tie up your money for a long period of time to get a 1%? It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
You know, one of the topics of conversation we seem to have frequently on lifetime income, as a matter of fact, we'll address this again coming up on Monday's program of lifetime income, is what do you do if you're retired and you're relying on a stream of income in this rocky ocean of a market? What are you going to do?
Yeah, I mean, it creates a major problem, because unlike, let's say, John, with our parents who, you know, maybe worked, they had Social Security, they had a defined benefit pension plan that probably covered 70 to 80% of their salary. That still happens in government or if you're a teacher. But for the private sector, John, that world no longer exists. You know, basically what you have when you retire, if you worked in the private sector, you do have Social Security, depending on when you take it, in terms of how much you're going to get. If you wait to age 66, obviously you're going to get all that. But outside of Social Security, it's basically what you saved, put away in your 401k program. Now, going back 15 years ago, that wasn't an issue because the stock market had been going up for two decades. Interest rates were in the 7 and 8% range. If you were looking at bonds, you were getting 5 or 6% and money market funds are at the bank. That's not the world we live in today. We've been at zero interest rates for close to 8 years. So if you get completely into cash, you're going to end up spending your principal anyway because you're not going to be generating any income that's going to support your lifestyle. So that's why I'm just not a big proponent of cash right now, because what are you going to do if you have to get a check? Now, this doesn't apply to everybody. I mean, if you're working, you're putting money in a 401k program, I still wouldn't recommend it either. Remember, there's something called dollar cost averaging. So every month you have money taken out of your paycheck and it goes into the mutual funds that you've picked in your 401k program. If the market is down like it is in the beginning of the year, that means the money that you are putting in the market right now, your money is buying more shares of those mutual funds. So that over the long term, you don't care about where the market is now. What you're really going to care is how many shares you own of those mutual funds 10, 20, 30 years or 40 years from now when you retire. So if you're dollar cost averaging every month in your 401k program, my goodness, going to cash right now is the wrong thing. Because what you want to be doing is buying more shares. As the share price comes down, your money is buying more for your money. It's like the market has gone on sale. You're picking up shares at lower prices. So that's one of the reasons, even for a younger person, John, I wouldn't recommend completely going out of the market. It just doesn't make a lot of sense if you have a long-term view of where you want to be 10, 20, 30, or 40 years from now.
I know, Jim, your own philosophy there, you're active managers of your clients' money in this area, but I have never known you to go to 100% to cash. So you're always in something.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't make a lot of sense, because if you go 100% in cash, you're really speculating. You're assuming a couple things. Number one, you've gotten out at the top of the market. Number two, you're going to get in at the bottom of the market. So you're either raising cash, reallocating, or you're putting your money, depending on what's happening in the economy and the market. And the other thing, John, we really don't know, just like it happened in March of 2009 when the Fed got rid of FASB 157, which was mark-to-market accounting, which was causing a lot of the problems that our major banks were facing. So how do you know at a press conference next week or in future FOMC meetings that the Fed is going to start changing its language, it's going to take corrective action, and we will have greater certainty? So if you're completely out of the market, chances are, and we saw this, a good example of this was what happened last August. We were down, I think by the time of the August lows, we were down about 12% in the markets. And then in 1 week, the Dow Industrial Average was up over 1,000 points, just as it was down over 1,000 points in a week since the beginning of the year. So that's why you don't completely want to be out of things. You might want to get more defensive. And for goodness sakes, you want to be diversified, because that is really one of the most important things to do. If you have some money in cash, you have some money in bonds, well, while stocks have been going down, bonds have been going up. And so this brings a little bit more stability to the portfolio. What you don't want to do is have everything in stocks, because unless you're taking a longer term view, because then you're more vulnerable to what goes on in the market. So, John, this is a time to be defensive. It's also a time to be diversified. But I just don't like cash right now because it's paying zero. And it's likely to pay zero this year. It's been that way for 8 years. And it's likely to be that way for a few more years, at least as a minimum. And so that's why, John, particularly if you're saving for retirement, as I mentioned, you can dollar cost average into your mutual fund if you're working. If you're retired, you have to have a source of income, whether it's dividend paying stocks, maybe some laddered bonds, maybe some CDs at the bank. But you need that income from your investments to live on. If you go all into cash, what are you going to do for income?
Last week, you mentioned just a tad about buying bonds. Why don't you explain that in more detail about what you're doing?
Now, one of the things that has happened as a result of the Fed tightening and the dollar rising is we've seen credit spreads widen. In other words, the interest rates that are being offered on corporate bonds has gone up versus, let's say, the interest rate on sovereign bonds, which have gone down as a result of global QE. And so this has created an opportunity because these bond spreads have increased, meaning interest rates have risen. So, you know, we're looking at the bond market in the 2 to 3 year, maybe 4 year range, primarily in the 2 year range, where we're able to pick up between 3.5-4%. Sometimes we've been able to pick up 5%, and as much of, in one case, we picked up yields of close to 10%. And a lot of that is being caused by the turbulence that we saw in the credit markets, mutual funds having to liquidate bonds. And when they're doing that, they are creating lower prices, which creates an opportunity. The other thing that we've seen, too, is there's a lot of disparity between, let's say, the ratings on bonds. So, for example, you may have a bond, like we were able to pick up a telecom bond that was rated double B, which was just below what I call investment grade. And this was a result when they issued their bond 3 years ago, they were taking on additional debt to expand their infrastructure. Now, you fast forward 3 years later, their cash flow is almost 2 to 3 times greater than when it was at the time the bond was issued and rated, but the rating agencies haven't revisited this. So we look at, for example, what Bloomberg evaluates these bonds, which are more up to date based on cash flow, the balance sheet, and interest coverage. And there's a disparity in on a Bloomberg rating, it's investment grade. So we look for those special kind of opportunities. But John, that's what you have to do in this kind of market. I like the corporate bond space in the 1 to 2 year range. I'd rather be making 4, maybe as much as 5% on money than sitting in cash at zero. And so we think this is a good place to hide while this thing sorts itself out, and it creates probably a lot more stability in the portfolio versus just being 100% in stock. So I just think this is a great place to be right now. There's a lot of opportunities that have been created as a result of widening credit spreads, the turbulence in the market, and investors panicking and selling their bond funds, which in turn is causing, as Dalio was mentioning, is causing a lot of these fund managers to sell off assets at distressed prices, which is an opportunity.
This would bring us back to something which, by the way, Dalio mentioned, and you've always mentioned, and that is when you're in these types of waters, a diversified portfolio.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that sort of went out of fashion after the financial crisis is people were looking kind of like when you go to a doctor and the doctor says, well, you got a diet, you got to exercise, there are a lot of things you need to do. And a lot of people say, well, just give me a pill. Well, what happened after the financial crisis? People were looking for a pill. They were looking for one easy solution, whether it was going all into cash or it was going all into bond funds, or it was going all into precious metals. And that's never what you want to do with the portfolio. You don't want to have all your assets in one asset class. You want to have stocks. You want to have bonds. You want to have some cash. Certainly, you can have room for gold, but certainly nowhere near what I've seen people do, especially when you listen to some of these prophets of doom. They want you to put everything you have in gold and silver, and you've lost a fortune if you've followed that advice. So you want to have a diversified portfolio. That has not changed. It's been one of the prudent things to do if you're an investor, and it's one of the prudent things that you want to be doing right now. If you have good dividend-paying stocks, you're relying on those dividends for living to pay your bills, you want to keep those. You don't want to go into cash and then give up all your income, and then what you're going to end up doing is spending your principal. You want to have money in bonds, so you have a certain safety bucket that you rely on that provides you income. And right now, there's some opportunities out in this market if you're an investor willing to diversify.
All right, Jim, so putting this all together in a mini battle plan here. Number one, we expect the markets to be turbulent until they get some certainty from the Fed, and that's not right on the horizon yet anyway. Two, you don't advise getting completely out of the stock market and into cash. It doesn't earn you much of anything right now. Three, however, you need to be defensive in the types of stocks you're holding. And four, the rule of thumb is always to diversify. And having said that too, by the way, Jim, obviously we're going to be playing the speculation game, will the Fed or won't they? But that's March, so we have a little ways to go here. Anything else we're looking at on the horizon?
Well, actually, next week, the first FOMC meeting will be on the 26th and 27th. So given all the market turbulence here, the markets are going to be looking for some kind of clarity from the Fed. And all I can say is the Fed better be a little bit more dovish than where they were in December, and then give some kind of benchmark or something to assuage the market's fears that, hey, you guys aren't going to run us off a cliff. So that's coming up next Tuesday and Wednesday. We're also in the middle of corporate earnings season. That's getting into full swing. So two things going on, the Fed, and that's probably the most important right now because people are really saying, are you guys going to do this? Because right now the consensus is they go in March. The Fed will be meeting on the 15th and 16th of March when it's widely expected that will be the first increase for 2016. So they're going to look for some kind of clues as to what the Fed is going to do. All that is coming up next week. We'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.